Karen, we have been working on getting Jared Sharp to come for a Friday night lecture and a Saturday night invitation and workshop. And Mary has kindly included his classes. And I know that if somebody from Laverne File.
Laverne
wants to come, and I thought she would be very acceptable. So she's coming in. There are a few others that aren't. Anyway, we're having it at the Art Center, which is just happened. Yeah.
Oh, that's here.
Yes. We went to Laverne. So April 1st is the lecture, 7:30 to 9:30.
And then...
You said something about a lunch. Is that really a lunch? Is that
no.
That's a lecture, but then the other places?
Yeah, in my house, the next day on Saturday, the 2nd, will be
1:30 to 4:30.
That's
the workshop, and I will be sending an email out to all the people who are signed up.
Oh, and that's
for directions. Yes, I'll send directions out.
It's to your
And for the workshop, everyone has to read one of Daryl's books and then come up with discussion questions. They're very small. Jane, would you show the one just to see how small they are? But they're packed full. They're packed full.
Yeah.
So they're not really big volumes or anything, but and they're an easy read, but they're just delightful.
Did you order these?
This one I borrowed from Tyler.
Daryl shipped about 5 copies of each one of his books. Gary has them also.
You're welcome to borrow mine
if you want to borrow his, or if you would like to purchase one. I could always bring it to class early if you just let me know.
How much are they?
25.
Them on Amazon are you can get better news. I got one for $12.50 that's new from another, 16 something.
So the copies you have benefit inner city books.
Yeah.
If people want to come to the Friends of Young lecture, it says prepay.
If you prepay, it's $15.
Yeah, right,
at the door, it's $20.
Who do they prepay to?
Me.
You?
Yes.
Okay, I will just
jump. And that's for the evening?
Uh-huh.
And what about the daytime?
For the workshop, you would pay me as...
And how much is it?
It's $50.
Are you going to come
down? We begged. Cajoled. Seduced. Flirted.
We filled him full of alcoholic beverages.
I remember once when we were having Scott Peck's speaker, and I went up just to see where he put his stuff. Jim, I said, I followed Jim.
He brought his own Jim. That reminds me of... What's his name? The guy that used to do Paris Reading.
Oh, I know who you mean.
Yeah.
The one
that
was at your house?
Yeah. We were serving. We hosted it and went to the Writer Center. We had beer and wine, everybody had. He went scotch. So we gave him our scotch.
Yeah. We had a problem like that once. He just went to our camp.
Okay, well, thanks. These guys have done a lot of work. Appreciate it. Who knows how long Daryl's going to be on this earth? I mean, he literally will be coming here in a wheelchair. He's got very bad circulation, and I think 30 or 40 years of smoking and drinking, womanizing, caught up with him. Daryl Sharp. But we got him to come, and I think it'll be fun. It'll be different than anything else you've ever heard. Because he's funny and serious at the same time. And the idea was, I mentioned this last time, but for those of you who aren't here, you guys have done a lot of work, and we go to these lectures. I get turned off by the obnoxious egotists and the stupid questions. Why not just have something that are for folks who have worked hard to learn Jung? So we won't be talking about what it means if you dream in color. We'll be talking about issues that we have all worked with for the last 5 or 10 years. Hopefully that would be more satisfying.
So. Sure,
yeah, but by making an invitation only and prepaid. Yeah, so...
Saturday, not Friday.
Right, Friday's open for anyone who wants to come, but Saturday is, yeah, we want to make sure that we're all at the equal level.
So it'll be fine. And then we're having snacks, I think, afterwards.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And he's a fine guy. Funny and serious, as I said, at the same time. Housekeeping details real quick. We missed one because of the weather. And really due to somebody else's error, which I didn't really protest too much because it would have been a mess for them to change. But they scheduled me for a weekend different than I had planned, and it hits one of our classes. So so we're going to miss two classes. We missed one, and then I'm going to cancel April. March 17th. Yeah. So what I thought is we could put one more on June 2nd. June 2nd. And then for the other one, that those of you who paid in advance, well, I'll just apply that to the fall semester's classes. How does that sound? Mm-hmm.
So June 2nd.
June 2nd, yeah. Okay, I might have done myself. See, I need to tell Tammy, and we need to... And Ann's all on vacation.
Oh,
yeah.
Ann.
So, Ann. Okay. Well, quick review. We've been dealing with this whole issue of eros and logos. Desire and meaning. The self's manifesting if we accept our emotional and instinctual interests in life, complicated though they may be. He then returned to that theme again in the last bit we did, where he meets a destitute man. And they discuss the difference between high and low. The point there, I think, is that sometimes we have to live out desires that aren't normally what we would think our social station should permit us. Suppose a guy falls in love with a hooker, or a Republican falls in love with a Democrat, or...
Watch Woody Allen's new movie, You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger.
Uh-huh. Same idea, probably.
The husband falls in love and marries a hooker.
Yeah.
It's Anthony Hopkins, and it's very good.
Is it?
You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger.
That's the name of it?
Yeah. I was... telling this to a friend of mine, we were discussing Jung a little bit, and a friend of his actually fell in love with a prostitute, married her, and she continued her work. Yep. And he said, this is all, you know, for my friend, I don't know this individual. I mean, I think she was a call girl, she wasn't a streetwalker or anything. But he said, I had to realize that was the package, and I had to accept it if I wanted to be with her. So that happens, you know, we hope it doesn't happen to us. But it does happen. Your eros has its own line. That's sort of the bottom line here. And we excuse ourselves from these complications, but often at the cost of a very boring and conventional life, because the self often comes through in these complications. We'll be talking more about that. I have to confess, for the first time today, I said, Jung, what on earth are you talking about? I was confused. So we're going to have to work through some of this together. I don't understand some of the things he was saying about the spirit and the logos. But that's where we've been, and we pick up 266.
Did we start with the ink line?
My notes end on 266.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I made a note, but
Yes.
As a drop in the ocean, that's what I was looking for. I'll just sum up that paragraph, I think. What's so important there, and you don't see it often, but I just saw one recently, and those most of you have done the dream analysis seminar. Well, remember, the guy had a dream that he was looking at time, and time was a stream of stripes, and each stripe was, of course, a very small part of the stream of time, but he was working on his stripe nonetheless. And the immediate thing I think a dream like that responds to is, you know, you do all this inner work and you sometimes certainly say to yourself, why the hell do I bother? I'm going to be dead in 10 or 20 years. So what if I get conscious? Why not just go out and have fun? What's the point of all this work if I am such a small speck in everything? I think everyone sooner or later must have that feeling. And yet the dream says, well, so what? Work on your stripe. Even though it's a small piece, I don't think the dream would have brought that up if it weren't important. So that, I think, is what he's getting at here. As a drop in the ocean, you take part in the current ebb and flow. We've been talking about all this stuff of the instinct, meaning, the self, blah, blah, blah. And he comes back and says, even though you're very small, this is an important thing. Or the voices in him are saying, even though you are very small, this is an important thing.
Well, this is also a contrast, too, with the heights, being in this current and ebb of the unconscious.
Yes.
As opposed to the height. He's making a contrast here.
Yes. So. Yeah, that's good, yeah. You wander vast distances in blurred currents and wash up on strange shores, not knowing how you got there.
You know, the Gnostics portrayed the soul as a drop. Okay. It fell into the ocean.
As in your painting.
Mm-hmm. They talk about that as being the mechanism whereby the soul is created, as this drop from whatever energy Sophia represents. So even though it's part of a huge ocean, it is. That thing doesn't happen unless there are all the drops. So each drop is like an essential aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Each drop is? You said it doesn't happen with all the drops.
I said that that Gnostic idea seems to indicate that this ocean doesn't exist without all of the individual drops. So each drop is an essential aspect.
I believe that very strongly. And I think the antidote to that feeling is the more we do work on our stripe or our drop, it does have an effect somewhere. We really do expand beyond.
How does that fit if we don't do what we were supposed to do?
I think then nothing happens.
What about that patient who had that he didn't finish his work? I mean, and he just had a horrible life. He went to prison.
Which one?
I did a thing. It was a big seminar. Somebody came to Dr. Hume and he just didn't want to do any work. And his life just deteriorated.
Well, he certainly talked about situations like that. You know, it's hard to say, but I think that we all really do have a place in the whole. And you could almost say that's what individuation is. I mean, that this is my looking for another definition of it. That to be individuation means becoming a person of significance, making your difference. And yes, you can fail it. Yeah, good. It bothers me, too.
Wouldn't you say, just a small group we have studying here, that most people might fail, might not really have that goal, might not see that goal?
Beyond being interested in Jung, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. And it might be the shift in consciousness that we are being called to make, or our society will fail.
Coming.
Yeah, it's, well, I don't know if it's coming inexorably, but it's certainly a danger, I think. The next couple paragraphs I'll look at, they're not telling anything new. They're almost poetic descriptions of what he's just put forward. From endless blue plains you sink into black depths. Luminous fish draw you, marvelous branches twine around you from above. You slip through columns and twist and twisting and wavering dark-leaved plants, and the sea takes you up again in bright green water to white sandy coast. And a wave foams you ashore and swallows you back again, and a wide smooth swell lifts you softly and leads you again to new regions, to twisting plants, to slowly creeping slimy polyps, and the green water and white sand of breaking surf. But from far off your thoughts shine to you above the sea in a golden light, like the moon emerging from the tide, and you become aware of yourself from afar, and longing seizes you and the will for your own movement. You want to cross over from being to becoming, since you have recognized the breath of the sea and its flowing that leads you here and there without your ever adhering. You have also recognized its surge that bears you to alien shores and carries you back and gargles you up and down. That's just beautiful prose, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the next paragraph goes sort of back to the issue of being entwined in the collective. And, of course, that's the opposite of becoming yourself. That's being defined by the outside rather than having your effect on the outside. And then he talks about the knowledge of death would be dying to that old collective attitude, which feels like dying. And more the scriptures, I think, again, very beautiful. One who becomes grows aware of life, whereas one who simply exists never will, since he is in the midst of life. He needs the heights and singleness to become aware of life, but in life he becomes aware of death. And it's good that you become aware of collective debt, since then you know why your singleness and your heights are good. And I almost think, you know, I can divide my friends up into two categories. Those who have not changed and have no new interests in the last 30 years, and those who do. Who at 60 are taking up new things, taking on new challenges, and so on. And to make that shift means going through a death.
And he's also saying it's escaping a death.
Yeah. By consciously facing your existential death, you escape the death of petrification.
Collective,
yeah, petrification. And, you know, I think the older you get, the harder it is to always keep life interesting. Our energy isn't as strong and so on, but nonetheless, the process is there if we want it, if we want to pay the price. I think it's worth it. So that's where he ends. I went into the inner death and saw that outer dying is better than inner death. See the last couple sentences on the second column on 267. And I decided to die outside and to live within. For that reason, I turned away and sought the place of the inner life. And I think, you know, in later life, you might have put that differently. And you've heard me say many times, and I think Jung worked on the individuation process internally. We now are being challenged to understand its manifestations outwardly. But you can see why he did it. He had to go in to find this inner process and saw the inner life inwardly. I think inner life is both inward and outward.
Also might be why he said, I'm so glad I don't have to be a union. you have to take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Without what you...
I think it's exciting, but see what we can do is in time. Okay, that's that section.
Are you at the anchor right now?
Yeah.
The moon symbolism is sort of opaque to me in a way.
Well, this whole blasted thing is opaque to me.
He compares the moon to your height, then he says it's dead. And yet it's dead, and yet it's the preserver of souls.
Well, it gets worse, so hang on.
So I just found that very curious, the way he speaks of the moon.
Let's look at the picture first, see if this gives us any... I don't think the picture's all that unique, but you guys see things I don't.
Now, it's called Dies, is that right?
Dies 1, right.
Now, that was curious. Because in Latin, dies is the red letter day.
What's wrong with the color there?
Yeah, it's really odd.
Oh, I think it is the... No, that is the connection. You want to try it?
Try. And it also means space of time. It means the appointed time. It means a lifetime. And it means a day. All those things are gathered together in the word dies.
I don't know what he means. The phrase that is so prevalent in theology is dies irae, the day of judgment. So I wonder if his use of dies here means the day of judgment.
Appointed time one of the meanings of
A big day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Red letter day.
A red letter day.
Uh-huh, and that's supposed to be, is it red? I can't remember, golden.
No, that's an accurate color representation, I think.
I can't remember. Well, I thought, you know, with this section he starts talking about the word.
Right.
And all of these shapes he's put around D for DA, the appointed time, are abstractions.
Okay.
They're like abstractions of writing. Almost.
Okay.
And also, at this point, the art changes into a sort of, he begins to introduce the abstract into the art.
Okay.
So that it's almost as though the idea of word equal abstraction equal the introduction of a new level of experience.
Yes, that's. I believe that's true. That much I get.
What did I say? I said it's the idea, the introduction of the concept of the word mm-hmm. introduces the concept of abstraction, which also seems to happen when he enters into a new level of experience. And that abstraction is reflected in the artwork that begins to happen now. You know, the abstract shape is introduced, and those abstract shapes almost seem to be a language of image that he employs when he, which he also combines with reality in his images. So that, you know, there are those abstractions of shapes combined in a real scene. And it's as though he's making a meeting place between symbol and reality. And that's what he seems to be expressing to me.
Yeah. Where we'll go, I think, and let's go through this together, and I solicit your input, because I was confused at several points here. Trying to now to always build a thread between what we've just done and what we're doing. I think that's helpful. And see, we've been talking about body and spirit, instinct and meaning, how he realizes he has to face his erotic desire in order to move forward in being able to understand the thoughts that are coming to him, the meaning of the thoughts that are coming to him, the worldview that's being manifested to him, namely Jungian psychology, what his role in life is to be, who he is, and so on. Okay, that's what we've been doing. Last bit, we talked about the low guy. Now I think we're talking about the high guy. We've gone from perversity, so to speak, and this chapter is an exploration of what is meaning. Now, it's set off as a separate chapter, but we always have to remember it's been followed by many chapters of body, instinct, desire. So he's turned from how do you get it to what do you get? And the abstraction is a mental pattern of who you are that you are then challenged to live. But at this point, it is a mental pattern. It is an abstraction, which is why I think you're right in what you were saying. You get the idea of what you should do. You get the idea of what you can be. You haven't done it yet. You have to entertain it as an abstraction first, but you have to understand what is being asked of you first. You can fail in understanding it, so abstraction is important. But having understood it, you cannot put it into being, because abstraction can remain a thought and never become a reality. So it's both a revelation and a danger. Does that make sense? I think that's what's going on here. I think that's what he's trying to do. So that's why the passage is so confusing, because everything he's saying is going to be two things at the same time. It's an answer and a seduction. Putting it very simply, you can entertain the meaning of a dream, and you can say, oh yes, I understand that, and never do anything about it. You, of course, have to understand it first and you can fail in understanding it, but once you've understood it, you can certainly fail in putting that understanding in reality.
And that's what I meant, that the artwork seemed to be attempting from here on to bring that technique of abstraction, which he employed,
into reality.
Into a reality, into the space in between.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Because, I'll have to follow up on that. I'm one chapter ahead of you, so... in this chapter, I think he's simply dealing with, though, the nature of insight.
Yeah, I'm not reading ahead.
Oh, I don't think he gets there yet here.
Right. I think artwork sometimes employs the thing that is to come. So perhaps that's why the artwork is introducing
the abstraction.
The idea of marrying. Well, here we have pure abstraction with the shapes that are like handwriting. But are not.
Uh-huh.
And then he takes those shapes and eventually marries them into his imagery, where he is portraying something in that he intends to be more realistic.
Well, keep that thought in mind and direct us through that. That's your assignment. I think you're right. We'll just have to follow it along.
And I wonder if those forms haven't been there all along through all the images, but they've evolved. It would be interesting to go back and look at them all to see. I mean, just looking at
if you want.
Just seeing some of those shapes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we have anything there, do we? Mm-hmm.
I felt something was really beginning with those distractions.
Mm-hmm.
Something that wasn't present before?
Yes. Visually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. I mean...
Well, the shape of that letter. I mean, the fact that it just doesn't go straight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's
looks like
traditional.
Yeah.
Could we decide that these are broken paint or intentional... intentional fissures.
We talked about them being intentional.
Intentional.
Creative.
But they're quite irregular. That could be the first manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They are irregular, but the abstractions he introduces in the one I'm talking about have a pattern.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Right.
Well, that's kind of an evolution if that's what that one is. Would you say?
Yeah, I would.
I don't know.
It's as if the idea of pattern first emerged, but the pattern was chaos. And now it's starting to get clearer. And
well, chaos is a pattern that they've discovered after all.
Yeah, I've got to study that stuff.
That's, you know, the Mandelbrot
set. Mm-hmm.
That is the pattern of chaos.
But, or let's say the pattern in chaos is not observed at that point of the fissures.
Good way to put it.
Yeah.
Seems some of those are abstract. I mean, I guess, mm-hmm. yeah. In a low form, mm-hmm. that's what I'm just thinking of. Maybe in a low form they've been appearing, but then they come into this pattern. I don't know.
Well, it's worth a thought.
Start to shape like a lure or a
letter. Mm-hmm.
Like that. He's definitely scared.
Well, it's certainly the first time that that they appear in a coherent, organized way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Ancient.
Yeah. Well, good. You got a lot more of it than I would have. So, let's dig in. Go slow because it's hard. I think it's really hard. On the following night, well, let's be aware that we are at December 30th, 1913. World War I had not started yet. Does anyone remember when it did start? Was it in the fall of 14?
I thought it was 14.
They all call it the 14-18 war.
Okay.
So anyway, we're getting close. This first part isn't too tough, but I'll read it. I saw the desert. Yellow sand all around, heaped up in waves, a terrible, irascible sun. Now the sun is going to be the big image here. A sky as blue as tarnished steel, the air shimmering above the earth. On my right side, a deeply cut valley with a dry riverbed, some languid grass and dusty brambles. In the sand, I see the tracks of naked feet that lead up from the rocky valley to the plateau. I follow them along a high dune. Skip a little bit. I pursue them attentively. Again, they follow the slope of the dune. Now they flow into another set of footprints, but it is the same set that I have already followed, the one ascending from the valley. Henceforth, I follow the footprints downward, I think big word, in astonishment. I soon reach the hot red rocks corroded by the wind. On the stone, the footprints are lost, but I see where the rock falls off in layers, and I climb down. The air glows, and the rock burns my soles. Now I've reached the bottom, another big word. There are the tracks again. They lead along the winding of the valley a short distance. Suddenly, I stand before a small hut covered in reeds made of mud bricks. A rickety wooden plank forms the door where a cross has been painted in red. I open it quietly. A haggard man covered in white linen mantle is sitting on a mat with his back leaning against the wall. Across his knees lies a book in yellow parchment with beautiful handwriting, a Greek gospel, without doubt. I am with an anchorite of the Libyan desert. Everyone know about anchorites? At the early phase of Christianity, you could say in a way that these were the first monks. They literally fled to the desert, lived alone, and meditated on the gospel. I think some of them wrote, I'm not sure how that all worked, but it was a huge tradition. Same as the monks of the desert, yeah. I think at this point, unorganized into orders. But you see, it's the beginning of the ascetic trend. Non-worldly. So the spirit, you see, is just here, is just the opposite of everything we've talked about.
So would you say for Jung, well, Jung ends with the phrase, for that reason I turned away and sought the place of the inner life. So
no.
For him, is the anchorite the one who seeks the inner life?
Yes, yes. And I think the reason it comes up, this is my opinion, the reason it comes up is the spirit he has been talking about is the same spirit that these guys were attending to. The spirit that comes through instinct is the same as the spirit that comes when you seek a celibate, detached existence. In other words, there's two ways to get to the spirit.
Say that again, Gary. The one who is still in touch with the instinct is the anchorite?
No, just the opposite. He has completely separated himself from the instinct. He's a monk. He's celibate. He lives alone. No women around, and he is attempting to feel and understand the Word of God. to experience the Word of God. And I think the reason it comes up here is Jung, too, is seeking the Word of God. For him, it comes through the instinct. The spirit comes through the instinct. The anchorite is an image of the spirit seeker. Jung gets it through the instinct. He, the anchorite, is seeking the spirit by extracting himself from life. Jung is seeking the spirit by throwing himself into life. But it's the same spirit. That form of seeking, and this is, again, my opinion, that form of seeking the spirit, the anchorite, was appropriate then. Jung's coming up with another way of seeking the spirit, but it's the same spirit that both are seeking. It's not like, oh, Jung is turning away from Christianity. Uh-uh. He is seeking the spirit again because it is to be found in the lowly, where then, 2,000 years ago, it was to be found in the in the ascetic, in the world denying. And Jung is realizing you don't find the spirit in the world denying anymore. You find the spirit in the world affirming. But he's going to this spirit because no matter where you find it, it's the same spirit. So he's going to an image of the spirit seeker to get an idea, what is this spirit that I'm seeking? I think that's how it fits in here.
Well, in a way he would have to go to the anchorite because he's trying to marry these two. He can't do it without the anchorite.
Right, he's going to them for guidance on what the spirit is, though he's going to come back and find it in a different way.
Well, and if he's uniting these two aspects of our experience, he couldn't ignore it.
This is the one aspect that he's trying to unite.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, what's interesting is, it's about where his philosophy is right now.
How so?
Well, the same thing with having done such a material world, and now people trying to find their souls in a more ascetic way. This economy doesn't really helping people get that perspective.
But he's trying to get to finding the spirit by not leaving the wilderness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean, but he's finding it in the world, but not with all the riches and of the church.
Right. 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 But he's going to the church, essentially going to the church. These guys are the founders of the church. He's going to the church to find out, what is it you guys were so interested in? That's how I understand it. And then, oh, you know what? It's the same thing I'm interested in, but I'm getting it in a different way. But still realizing there's much to be learned by from anyone who is devoted to the Spirit, whether they are world-denying or world-affirming. Because he's going to be talking now about the Logos, which is the meaning.
It's interesting. I can't speak for a lot because I don't know very much. But the Desert Fathers are becoming very popular.
Are they?
It's still useful.
We got a Desert Father here.
Mm-hmm. So he goes in to explore Logos?
I think so, yeah.
The word.
What is Logos?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. But you know, you couldn't fully experience Jung's ideas without abstraction.
And we always have to put ourselves back in Jung's head and remember all the things that he said about religion he hadn't said yet. And he had been trained in an atheistic psychology. Right. Here he's confronting the spirit. And he's realizing the spirit is a principle equal to the instinct. That's how I go with it.
Well, this is his first discovery of matter and spirit.
Or maybe it's his first discovery that there even is such a thing as spirit. I believe that's the point of it. Remember, he's dealing with an atheistic psychology and a socially frivolous time. And it's certainly not fashionable in his circle to be religious. But all of a sudden he's realizing, holy smokes, we can't go forward without religion. Or we can't go forward without the experiences that religion has up to this point explored. So he's confronting the nature of those experiences and will then later integrate them into his psychology. It's almost like he's saying, oh my God, yes, religion is important at this point.
And this spirit equals logos equals spirit of the depth.
Yes.
Spirit of the
depth. Okay. Okay, for 267. Zooming right along. Am I disturbing you, Father? 268. Here we'll go through this sentence by sentence. 268 at the top. This is where I start getting lost. And we're told in a footnote that in another place, Jung identified this anchorite as a certain historical figure whose name was Ammonius. So that's why A. Or I guess it could be anchorite too, but I think Ammonius. I'm a man, you do not disturb me, but do not call me Father. I am a man like you. So right away you can see just in that, don't call me Father. The seat of all Jung's work on withdrawing the projection of the God image. These little things are creeping in now. I'm a man like you. What is your desire? I come without desire. Well, we've just heard about desire for about the last 10 chapters. So that's why I say what Jung is doing is saying, okay, we've talked about spirit and desire. What in the world is this spirit thing? So then he goes to the anchorite. And he goes there just trying to understand spirit on its own terms. What is spirit? Again, remember, for us this is second nature because we've spent so much time discussing his work on spirit. He hadn't understood what spirit was yet at this point. I think we can skip a little bit. A little further down the page, time passes quickly. How is that possible? Your life must be frightfully monotonous. See where I am? Anchorite says, time certainly passes quickly for me, much too quickly even. It seems you are a pagan. Well, I think the first thing there is how it's impressing on Jung that the spirit is an interesting phenomenon in its own right. It is not something boring. So it's making this quest to what the spirit is interesting. He says, no, I'm not exactly. I was raised in the Christian faith. A little bit farther down. Again, forgive me. See where I am? My curiosity is great. What then do you do? What then do you occupy yourself with? Are you a child? To begin with, you see that I am reading and that I keep regular hours. Well, he's reading the Bible. We're going to see in particular the book of John. So I think Jung is simply coming into touch with a desire to understand the book of John, namely, in the beginning was the Word. The Word is the Logos, is the translation of the Greek Logos.
So the reason he's calling him a pagan is because Jung, he thinks that Jung does not understand what Christianity is.
Yeah. A little further down, how childishly you speak. Surely you know that one can read a book many times. Perhaps you almost know it by heart, and nevertheless it can be that, etc. A little bit further on that passage. Every word can work productively in your spirit. Well, we've got the spirit now. Look at the anchorite's next speech. You are astonishing. How then do you read this holy book? Do you really always see only one and the same meaning in it? Where do you come from? You are truly a pagan. So, you follow the importance of being challenged that he only sees one and the same meaning in it. It's brought to his attention that imagery can be interpreted in various ways. If he didn't know that, he would never be able to apply Christian imagery to the individuation process. So he's being made aware that imagery is, or a true myth, myth in the best sense of the word, a true myth has many levels of reference. Again, we know that. But going back to Jung's early years, it's dawning on him, I can look at the Christian story symbolically. It never occurred to me before. I can use it as a metaphor for my work. I think that's part of what the anchorite is giving him. And the fact that it is an anchorite means, and that isn't blasphemy. That isn't a diversion from religiosity. It is the nature of religious imagery to want to be applied to many realms. Well, it's probably time for a stretch.